For a message this morning, you can turn to the book of St. John. We'll be looking at chapters 11 and 12. I have a few questions for the children this morning. Who can tell me what the shortest verse in the Bible is? What does the shortest verse of the Bible say? Does anyone know? Kevin knows. What does it say? Jesus wept. We have that verse in our passage here this morning. Why did Jesus cry? What happened here? Does anyone know? What happened in this chapter that says that Jesus wept? Well, we can move this up to the youth. Surely somebody knows. Why did Jesus weep? Anyone who will tell us? Kevin. Because his good friend, Lazarus, whom he loved, was dead. And Jesus came, and it says that he wept. I don't know exactly why he wept, because Jesus had already told the disciples that he was dead, but this was to the glory of God, and Jesus full well knew that Lazarus was going to be alive again really soon. But Jesus was touched by death, and the Bible tells us that he wept. We have quite a long story here. John 11, the first 44 verses, gives us this account of Lazarus dying. Well, first of all, Jesus wasn't in Bethany anymore, but Mary and Martha send a message to him, probably by a messenger, that Lazarus is sick. And Jesus knew that he was going to die. He told the disciples that. And if you're, many of us have, know the feeling of making a decision. Someone passed away, and do we go? Do we go visit? Do we go to the viewing? Or do we go to the funeral? Do we go or do we stay? And we have to weigh this out. And that happened here. And Jesus' disciples were kind of concerned, and they said, "You're not going to go there, are you?" Verse 7 and 8 here, what do they say? The Jews were trying to stone you lately there. And we left. You're not going to go back now because of Lazarus, are you? Put your life at stake because of Lazarus. And I'm not sure exactly how to explain Jesus' answer there in 9 and 10, but that's not our subject, but this is the setting of the story of the account. And they did go back. And they went back to the hot spot. And we're going to see some of that as we go through the message, looking at the setting here, that they were really out to get Jesus at this time. Versus, if we go to after this account of Lazarus ended in verse 44, where Jesus said, "Loose him and let him go." And then we go into where the chief priests and the Pharisees, they gathered together. And we move down to verse 54 here, and Jesus walked no more openly. Did he go into hiding? I believe in a out of the place, out of the way place there in Ephraim, and continued with his disciples. But yet, back in the hub there, this thing was really stirring, and these Pharisees, they sought for Jesus. Verse 57, they gave a commandment: if anybody knows where he is, we want to know. We want to take him. And then chapter 12 goes into, it was 6 days before the Passover. And Jesus came here to, again, out of that place near the wilderness. And he came to visit Lazarus and Martha and Mary. And he had supper with them. And it seems he stayed overnight there in Bethany. And then verse 12, we have him headed to Jerusalem. And one, I found, not everybody agrees how far this was. Someone thought it was maybe an hour and a half walk from Bethany to Jerusalem. Someone else thought a mile and a half. But it was a bit of a journey. And Jesus headed for Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was full of people. People had come from all over because it was the big event of the Passover. But there was another thing that the news was spreading like wildfire, and people had heard about Jesus and they'd heard about Lazarus, and they came to see what was happening, and they wanted to, just as much as see Lazarus, they wanted to see this man for themselves who'd been 4 days in the grave and now he's walking around again and he's alive like normal. That's what they're telling them anyway, and they want to see. And even John tells us here in this chapter that even the disciples were confused at this point, and they weren't making sense out of all this. And it wasn't till later that they understood, he says. Later they understood the significance of all that was happening. But what I'd like to go through and just point out to us 10 individuals or groups of individuals I have in this account. And every one of them had an encounter with Jesus, and they needed to make a decision. What will they do with Jesus? Will they believe or will they reject? I don't know where Sam was going with rejection this morning, but I have that word a few times in my message here too. And here we have people, as they came to Jesus, they needed to make a choice. And they needed to make a choice. What will they do with Jesus? And I'd like us to make it personal, and so I've titled the message, "What Will You Do With Jesus?" What will you do with Jesus? Let's look here. The first one I have picked out is from chapter 11, verse 45. This was immediately after Lazarus came forth. And Jesus said, "Loose him." Verse 45, "Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him." And we can understand, they saw someone raised from the dead and they believed on Jesus. They witnessed the miracle, but yet each of them faced a choice. Would they believe that Jesus was sent from God? Or would they choose to believe what the religious powers and elites of the day wanted them to believe? They had to choose. Would they go against the powerful opinions of the chief priests and the Pharisees? Would they choose to identify with Jesus at the risk of their life? Many chose to believe. But just for them is just like every one of us. The first choice to believe was only one of the steps, one of the choices, one of many, many choices. We can choose to believe in Jesus. And that's, at some point, we must make that choice. But as we do that, there are many, many more times we choose. Do we believe or do we reject? Do we believe or do we reject? It's not a once and done choice. They needed to accept in faith and then keep accepting and keep believing. And then in verse 46, we have an interesting group of people. "But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done." I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of supposition here. But I see these people that doesn't say they were against Jesus. Doesn't say they believed on Jesus. I picture a group that didn't want to make the hard choice. And they said, "We'll go talk to the chief priests and the Pharisees. We'll go talk to the people that know. We'll see what they decide. And we'll go with that." A group of the maybe we could call them choosing the path of least resistance. Those that don't want to stand up and make a choice, we'll see what the consensus is. And maybe we can identify with that. Maybe we're like that. We'd rather ride along and just stay out of the limelight rather than make the choice to believe Jesus. The third group of people we've talked about already, and I see in verse 47 and 48 here, then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, "What do we? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and our nation." And then John gives us kind of the inside. I don't know how John knew what all got discussed there in that council. I can't believe it was an open public council that the disciples were at. But one of them spoke here, this man named Caiaphas. He was the high priest that year. And interesting, look at what verse 51 says. He spake not of himself, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for the nation. And not for that nation only, but also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. But I don't think he really understood what he said, and I don't think the rest of them did, because from that day, verse 53, from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. The enemies of Jesus is the group of people we're looking at here. They gathered a council and they said, "We have a problem. Everybody's going to go after him. We've got to do something to stop this. If we leave him alone..." Well, no, that's not an option, they said. And ultimately, they decided that he must die. And then if we move over to chapter 12, verses 10 and 11, look what we see here. These people, like every one of us, if we choose to refuse a thief, are we following Jesus for the blessings? Are we following Jesus because I might get something out of it? We just looked at a Sunday school lesson of the blessedness of the saints. But if that's what did that Ed brought out, I think read from the teacher's guide, if serving Jesus is drudgery, we're obviously in the wrong, doing it for the wrong reason. If we won't take the time, but if we turn back to Matthew's account, right after these words is when it says that Judas went to the chief priests and offered to betray Jesus. They didn't, read Matthew, I think it's in Matthew 25, I just read it this morning, and I think the way I understand it, they didn't come after him. He went to them this very occasion, turned him against Jesus. And it boggles our minds, doesn't it? But Judas made a choice. Judas had been making choices. And Judas ultimately rejected Jesus and betrayed him with a kiss. And so, what will you do with Jesus? How little silver does it take for me to choose silver over Jesus? Let's look at chapter 12, verse 9, I see the ninth group of people I'd like to point out. Much people of the Jews, therefore, knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. We have a curious crowd. They want to not only see Jesus, but they want to see Lazarus, this man who was raised from the dead. Whoever heard of someone being in a grave 4 days and then someone calling him out by words? But curious isn't a bad thing, is it? There's no judgment on this group of people. They said, "Let's go see." But then they saw. And like every one of us, every time we see Jesus again, we're faced with a choice. What will you do with Jesus? And every one of these curious onlookers that had heard all these things and wanted to see, they needed to make a choice. Would they believe and follow Jesus as well? Some did. Would they reject Jesus and keep on the safe side with those Pharisees and chief priests? Some chose that. What will you do with Jesus? The 10th group of people is over in chapter 12 and verse 20. And there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. The same came therefore to Philip, which was at Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, Sir, we would see Jesus. And Philip cometh and telleth Andrew. And again, Andrew and Philip go to tell Jesus. These people asked to see Jesus. I don't know how they knew to ask Andrew, but they did. I don't know for sure who they were. It's very possible they were Jews that had been scattered and were living out scattered around and were called Greeks because they weren't residents of Judah, of Jerusalem. Or it could have been Greek proselytes, could have been Greek proselytes who had converted to the Jews and worshiped God and followed the law. Because there were devout worshipers who were not Jews. But regardless, they had come to Jerusalem. They were there to worship, it says, and they wanted to see Jesus. And so they asked Andrew. Did they ask Philip first? And then Philip went. No, they went to Philip. And then Philip went to Andrew, and then they went. And it doesn't really tell us, does it? But I like to think that they took them to Jesus. And we can be part of this group of people. Yes, we can. Even those of us who've known about Jesus ever since we can remember and have heard all the stories, are there not still times when we need to go to one of the disciples and we say, I need help to see Jesus? Things in life are so cloudy and confusing, and I've heard so many things, and we just need to ask for help to get a clear vision of Jesus again and desire to see Jesus. That's the 10 groups of people. You may be able to pick out some more here that we could have talked about. But I'd like to now move on to the second part of the message and look at Jesus' answer. It seems like, and here again, I have to read some of this in, and I hope I'm not doing injustice, but it seems to me like Jesus was there, and all these crowds of people that wanted to be with him, some believed, some didn't know if they did or they didn't, and some did not. And there's crowds of people there, and here's Jesus, and here come Andrew and Philip with some more people who want to see Jesus. And because they're the disciples, they can get their way kind of up to the front and they get to talk with Jesus. And what would you answer to a group of Greeks like this who said, we want to see Jesus? And I was a bit puzzled at Jesus' answer, but I believe that his answer was to more than just those Greeks. There were people. And Jesus looked at all these crowds of people, and unlike you and I, Jesus knew each individual in that crowd, and he knew where they were, what they were doing with him. He knew where they were. And he spoke, and the answer that he gave to in response to these Greeks coming and wanting to see him, he gave an answer there that everyone in that crowd needed to hear and understand. The disciples needed to, the Greeks needed to, the believers needed to, the unbelievers needed to hear this. And it's what every person since then has needed to hear as well, to understand what we need to do when we come to Jesus. And the choice that we need to make, what will we do? And Jesus answered, and he gave three paradoxes. Let's read starting at verse 23. And Jesus answered them, saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except the corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honor. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause came I unto this hour. Father, glorify thy name. We'll stop there. Jesus pointed out three paradoxes. He did more than pointed them out. He declared three paradoxes of the Christian life. Three paradoxes that everyone must experience who believes in him. Number one, verse 24, he says, you must die to live. And that's a paradox. It doesn't make sense to us. You must die to live. Life comes out of death, he said. And he showed the illustration of a seed, how a seed needs to die. And then by dying, new life, a sprout comes out of that seed. And then there's fruit. And there's much fruit, he says in verse 24. And Jesus himself is the ultimate example of this paradox. Jesus died that we all have life, eternal life. Galatians, Paul told the Galatians, and they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. And the New Testament tells us that when we die and we crucify the flesh, then we are raised to newness of life. And then we only start living. Verse 25, he gives a second paradox. He said, if you love life, you'll lose it. If you hate life, you'll gain life. And that's exactly the opposite of what each of us was born believing. Each of us was born believing that we need to guard and protect me, not give and hate life. Hate doesn't mean that we despise it in this way, but it means to love a lot less, some distant second. Jesus said, if you give it up, you'll keep it. If you give up your life, you'll keep your life. I have a quote here. Those who love life and hold the tightest to it are the most miserable and worthless failures in life. Like I said, exactly opposite of what we were born, programmed, believing. But those who love life and hold the tightest to it are the most miserable and worthless failures in life. Many a man hugs himself to death and loses his life by overloving it. And we don't need that explained to us, do we? We understand that. Our natural tendency is to love self and to, what's this? Hug himself to death. And we are that way by nature. Hating life is against the carnal understanding of any person, because we were all born seeing my life as the most important thing there is. It's more important than other people. It's more important than truth. It's more important than righteousness. But Jesus calls us to get our priorities in order and to hold my life and what's important to me loosely and let it go. And then we only start living. And it's a paradox that we must understand to believe in Jesus. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he, Jesus, laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brethren. Again, Jesus is the ultimate example of this paradox, this principle that he declared there that day to the crowds of people. The third paradox is in verse 26. He says, if any man serve me, let him follow me. And whoever serves me, him will my Father honor. The paradox is simply this. You must serve to receive honor. And again, that's backwards. That's totally reversed from what we think. We're born believing that honor comes by being served. That's the way we think. And Jesus says, if someone wants honor, he needs to serve. He needs to be low. He needs to. And we aren't so used to their terminologies, but there were people who were slaves, and Jesus said, that's who my Father will honor, those who serve me. How do these paradoxes, as we choose what to do with Jesus, how do these paradoxes become practical to us? What Jesus is teaching here is the opposite of self-indulgence, the opposite of doing what pleases me, the opposite of following what my flesh craves. It's trading my ambitions and my goals and my agenda for a higher cause. And that's the answer Jesus gave to those crowds who were deciding what to do with Jesus. And he said, give up yourself and follow me. Turn to Colossians chapter 3. I'd like to read a number of verses here as we think of making these paradoxes, the teachings of Jesus, practical to us. Colossians chapter 3, I'd like to read the first number of verses. Verse 1, if ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. And we'll stop there. It goes on with a list of deeds that need to be put to death. Here we have Paul repeating in a lot of ways exactly what Jesus said there in John 12. In verse 2, believing on Jesus, deciding to believe on Jesus, is a change of affections. What we love must change. Rather than loving myself, I love Jesus. Rather than serving myself, I serve Jesus. What we love, we set our affection on things above. And then we look at verse 3, and we have this same principle I talked about a little bit back in the last, in looking at John 12. The most alive people are the ones who truthfully can have this testimony. Ye are dead. Your own personal ambitions, what you love, is dead. And instead, you're alive in Christ. Your life is hid in Christ. The Amplified Bible says for this verse, For as far as the world is concerned, you have died, and your new, real life is hidden with Christ in God. And then we have this command to mortify the members that are on the earth. As we look at practical 2021 choices, what will you do with Jesus? I have here four points that we need to address. As we think of dying to live, as we think of, I'm sorry, that one slipped my mind. The second one. As we think of giving to live, dying to live, and loving life, or hating life to gain life, or serving to receive honor. The first one we have here in Colossians, that we must mortify sinful desires and deeds. Mortify them. This is more than just going on defense against temptation. This is going on the offense, to mortify, to put them away, to crucify them. Taking control, subduing the urges and desires that are clearly called sin by God. That one's fairly easy to understand. And we know that that needs to be done. And by the power of God, we can overcome and we can mortify. But then as we move down the list, there's another list of decisions that we need to make. These things are what I'm going to call maybe in a gray area. They're not necessarily right or they're not necessarily wrong. But and often each of these by themselves is not that dangerous. But they create habits. And unless we draw some lines and personally say no to some things that we could argue are okay, we develop a lifestyle that grows more and more selfish and doesn't fit into the hating life and giving and serving Jesus and saying no to me. And these are things that the tempter tells us that others in the church and other fine Christians are fine with it, and surely we can too, and you can't directly refute them from the scripture and call them sin. And as we grow older and we mature, there are some of these decisions we make and some of these things that we choose to say no to because we look at how they would affect those half our age. And we choose to deny ourselves things for the sake of the younger and the weaker. And this becomes a Romans 14 subject. And I'm not prepared to launch into that in depth. And I'll tell you, I think I might have said it before, and I'll tell you again, if you haven't listened to the one that's recorded from Youth Institute, where Brother Joel and Martin dug right into Romans 14, do yourself a favor and listen to that message. And I hesitate to give a lot of practical examples because these are convictions and these are things that we choose for ourselves and say no to, and they're personal. And they're not something we just make a big deal out of because they're personal choices and we won't all be at the same place. But there's decisions and there's choices that following Jesus will cause us to say no to things that the flesh says are legitimate and okay. And we do it for various reasons. Do it for our own safety. Do it for the safety of our families. Do it for the younger. And I challenge us, what will you do with Jesus when he touches these areas in your life? And then there's a third set of, I'm going to call them desires that need to be controlled. They're right. They're God-given. They're natural desires. Things like eating and sleeping and resting. Things like comfort, power, and probably the most important one, success. Because God has created in each one of us a desire for success. It's all normal. And there's nothing unholy about any of these things I just mentioned. But left uncontrolled and left to become the guide of our lives, Satan will use them to destroy us. Satan will use the natural desire of power and success to destroy humans. Satan is using the natural desire to have an easy life to destroy many Christians. And so I challenge us to give it all to Jesus. What will we do with it? Jesus touches these things. Jesus asks us to give them. Jesus asks us to serve him so that we can be honored. Paul said, "But I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway." And then there's a fourth set of decisions that I'd like to point out. And these are things that can be good, bad, or in between. But they are things that hinder my usefulness to God and the kingdom. And God comes and he touches them. And God, my experience is often, as I, in my own life and as I've observed, is this often has to do with time and possessions. This often has to do with that pound of ointment, something that's prized. It's not wrong. It wasn't wrong for Mary to have it, but it was worth a lot. I don't know where she got it. Maybe it was a gift to her. Maybe it was an inheritance. Think about it. And God had use for that ointment. And she saw Jesus as worthy of receiving it. What will you do when Jesus touches that pound of ointment in your life? What will you do when Jesus touches that precious little bit of spare time you have for you? What will you do when Jesus touches and asks for more time in the kingdom and less time on all the other legitimate things that you have to do? What will you do with Jesus? So the only way for any of us to be ready to answer the call, the calls of God, whether it's through the church, many calls in smaller ways, is we need to have our love in order. Do we love self? Do we love life? Are we hugging ourselves to death, protecting what's precious to me, or is it all for Jesus? If we love life, we'll resist each call of God and we'll fear to give up any more, because we don't know what God will touch next and ask for next. But Jesus says if we just give our lives and open it all up, and what did Stan say, write God the blank check, then we'll only start living. Sometimes it's the smallest things that are the hardest. Just give up an extra hour of work to go to prayer meeting, or an hour or two to take time to chat with someone that needs you to listen. Give up 2 days to go to New York for Jesus. Moms have it. Give up half a day to go clean the church, you know, and we're all normal enough to know how this becomes very practical, doesn't it? But what will you do with Jesus? See, it's so much more than a one-time decision to just give my heart to Jesus and now I'm born again and on the way to heaven. Sure, it is that way, but it's a continual choice day after day after day. What will you do with Jesus in your priorities, in what you love and what you do and what you choose? And daily this becomes my choice. Me or Jesus? Me or Jesus? Who do I love? If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above. It's so much more than some nice words from Colossians 3. It comes down to hour by hour daily living. Who am I living for? Who do I love? Who am I serving? Am I like Mary, serving in devotion, or like Judas, a thief trying to steal from the program and from God's kingdom? Am I like those ones that were looking for the easy route, not having to stand up and make a choice and choose anything hard? Or like those who believed on Jesus and continued to choose? You see, Jesus didn't force himself on any one of these 10 groups of people, none of them. Each one of them had a choice. They chose. They chose, and many of them, most of them, I believe, had multiple opportunities. Choose or reject. Choose or reject Jesus. And so it is with us. Every one of us here has had many, many, many opportunities. And the question is for each of us again to answer today. What will you do with Jesus? I'd like to close with just some very precious words. We already read them. I don't know if they stood out to you, but they did to me. John 12, verse 26. Jesus said, "If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be." You see, for those who choose Jesus, he chooses us to be with him. He said, "I'm going to prepare a place. And if I go and prepare a place, I will come again and receive you unto myself." For those who choose Jesus, we have that great promise to look forward to. What will you do with Jesus? Let's kneel to pray.